From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
There'll be interviews where someone will say, like, oh, like, you know, that's a nice shirt, Mr. Dillon. And he'll be like, what? And they'll be like, your garment. That's like a nice garment. And he'll be like, your words, not mine. Like, you know, somehow as if he's questioning whether or not he's really wearing a shirt.
Chuck Klosterman on the art of the celebrity interview. We'll hear from him in a moment. This hour, we meet the press. We'll look back at the election season with the features editor at the satirical newspaper, The Onion. And celebrated writer Gay Talese on writing about the boxer.
The fighter becomes the chronicler of himself. He becomes the spokesperson for himself. He becomes the reminiscer of this awful experience.
Also, the shockingly true story of the National Enquirer.
I think that compared to mainstream journalism, working on the Enquirer was like being on a pirate ship.
As a rock critic and cultural commentator, Chuck Klosterman is a leading voice in the world of popular journalism. He's written for The New York Times Magazine, GQ, and The New Yorker. He's the author of several books, including his latest, Chuck Klosterman 4, A Decade of Curious People and Dangerous Ideas. Over the years, Klosterman has interviewed numerous celebrities, including Val Kilmer, Steve Nash, and Bono. He told Steve Paulson that interviewing celebrities is a tricky business.
There really isn't any upside for the celebrity to take part in an interview. They're interested often in having their pictures taken because that helps promote whatever product, whether it be a record or a movie that they're trying sort of to, you know, get consumed by the public. But I think that they're very aware of the fact that, like, for the most part, it hurts them to be interesting.
Right. If they say anything controversial, it's just going to come back to haunt them.
Well, and even if they say something that's not controversial, even if they just say something that's sort of compelling, like something that's kind of interesting, well, the story is going to be structured around this one interesting thing that they said when they sort of let their guard down and sort of just sort of talked freely. Well, then this one sort of, in their mind, maybe arbitrary statement they made is going to become part of their iconography because the story is going to be built around that. So if you're a celebrity and someone's interviewing you, I think that they got to justify in their mind, why should I tell this person something about me that he or she could, one, use to make me look ridiculous, or just sort of fold into a very conventional kind of fluffy piece that no one will care about then. I mean, if someone writes a positive story about someone, it gets very little attention. But if you have one thing and one story that sort of, I don't know, chips away at whatever the persona the artist tried to create, that's going to be copied over and over and over again on these websites, you know?
Well, let me get to Britney Spears. She's famous now for her public mental breakdown. But before that, when you interviewed her, there was a big question. Who's the real Britney? Is it the sex kitten or the girl next door?
Well, when you interview, or at least when I interviewed Britney Spears, and I asked her, like, how do you sort of reconcile this very clear dichotomy you've created between, you know, the hypersexual image that comes across in all your videos and all sort of the portraits of you as a person, and the fact that, you know, you kind of position yourself as just a nice girl from the South who sort of, how did I get caught up in all this, you know? And her response basically was that, not that she disagreed with this, or that, yeah, she realized it, but that's just part of the game. Her response was like, I've never even considered this. Like, I didn't know that this question even existed. Now, which is, in a way, seems impossible. It would seem to indicate that not only has she never read anything ever written about her or watched any time she was ever on television, it would almost be as if she had never really been interviewed before, because that's part of almost every story about her.
Well, here's a typical clip from one of Britney Spears' interviews.
She said before the performance, let's just feel it out and see what happens. So I didn't know it was going to be that long and everything, but it was cool.
Had you ever kissed a woman before?
No, I've never kissed a woman before.
Would you again?
Would I again? No, I would not do it. Oh, maybe with Madonna, but I'm
But that's it. You're going to stay true to Madonna as far as
kissing? Yeah, Madonna, yeah.
What does your mom think?
What does my mom think?
Yeah.
She thinks it was cool. She liked the performance. She knows it's about performing and it's not like, you know, so.
So it raises the question, is she one of the stupidest people on earth, or is she one of the savviest?
And when I was doing that story, it was for an issue of Esquire called Women We Love. So I sort of had to pose that question. You know, like I did not want to do a takedown piece on someone who agreed to be in the, you know, because I don't know. I mean, maybe she doesn't know. Maybe, you know, my assumption is she doesn't, kind of. Like, I don't think she's really aware of how insane her persona is.
Hmm. You know? Well, let me propose another example on the opposite extreme. Bono from U2, you know, serious guy who, you know, not only loves to be interviewed, but loves to talk about his music and loves to talk about saving the world. I mean, just the opposite end. I mean, he seems to be one celebrity who truly does like to be interviewed.
Well, Bono does like being interviewed. He would be the most self-aware celebrity I've ever spoken with. And the whole time you're with him, the question, at least in my mind, was sort of like, you know, is he really this interested in, like, solving, you know, or like, you know, absolving Africa of their third world debt and, like, you know, ending the AIDS crisis and helping humanity? Or is somehow this all wrapped up with the idea of being the vocalist in a rock band? And this is just a new way to sort of move the interest in U2 outside of just the musical sphere.
You'd have to be awfully cynical to think that. I mean, given all the extremes that he's gone to talk about, you know, getting rid of third world debt.
Yes, that's true. Yes, you'd have to be awfully cynical to think that Bono doesn't care about the world. But what's interesting is I do think somewhere in the middle of his career, he did make this decision to become a different person, right? And that he was not going to be – he was going to be – on stage, the most conventional of rock stars, and off stage, he was going to be the least conventional rock star, you know? I mean, every conversation Bono has, he has as if he's being filmed for a documentary. Hmm. Even among his bandmates, you know? He talks as though it's being filmed and that he realizes I am Bono, okay?
So that, does that mean he doesn't sound like a real person then?
Well, he sounds exactly like the person that we see on television.
I got so caught up with it, I ended up in Africa. I went to work with my wife, Ali, in Africa for a month in Ethiopia. It's shocking to see these Ethiopian people are very beautiful, dignified people, tall, incredibly handsome. And to see them with their heads shaved and sitting with blankets around them, begging for food, and they still looked
noble.
Noble.
You know, you talk about, you know, covering celebrities. What's the one thing that, you know, like, if you interview a celebrity and you talk to your friends about it, the question they always ask is, what is he really like?
Right.
You know, what is Tom York really like? What is David Lee Roth really like? And what they're really fundamentally asking is, the person that they present themselves as, how close is that to the person they are? Now, as an interviewer, you never really know. I mean, I can always tell when I've met a bad journalist because they'll say things like, I've met Madonna, or I know Marilyn Manson. Because they think, I've interviewed this person, I know them. They don't know them at all.
So do you feel like it's your job as an interviewer, as a journalist, to try to figure out who they really are? Is that what it's all about, ultimately?
You know, I have to admit, at this point in my life, I'm not sure what it really is all about. That's definitely, like, my views on journalism have changed fairly significantly over the last 5 years. But what I always try to do is I try to sort of make it as real as possible. So, you know, there's this cliche in journalism, it's sort of like, save your tough questions for the end, you know?
Right, you don't want them to walk out on you that.
And I think the complete opposite. To me, I ask the harder questions almost immediately if they're the most important questions. Now, if the person walks out, that's not a failed interview. That tells you more about that person than anything that they could have said. Because clearly they are so unwilling to respond to this one issue that they will actually leave knowing that that will become the totality of the story.
Now, you said that your thinking about journalism has changed radically over the last 5 years. What's changed?
Well, it's just interesting because now because I've written books, I have been interviewed. And as crazy as this sounds, I mean, as sort of obvious as this be, like, I have come to realize that, like, what happens in an interview and what the person being interviewed, what their intent is and what ends up being the product of that conversation, even when it's done very well, is really a fabricated sense of the interaction that happened.
You're creating a story, creating a narrative.
You're creating a narrative. Yeah. Well, you know, it's crazy. I mean, like, you know, I remember I wrote about this in my second book, actually. So I guess this has been 2003. I was supposed to interview Dave Perner of Soul Asylum over the phone. So we had like a 20-minute conversation or a 30-minute conversation. But I had to write a long story about it for the Akron Beacon Journal, like, you know, a couple thousand words. So I ended up taking this one sort of statement he had made about his relationship with Winona Ryder, which he had ended, you know, a few years prior. And he almost kind of talked around the issue. But I took one statement and I sort of built a story. I ended up building a psychological profile about Dave Perner from this one statement he had made about Winona Ryder. People love this story, but I mean, I realize how ridiculous that is and how really that is indicative of most celebrity journalism.
Who's the celebrity you'd most want to interview?
I'd like to interview Axl Rose, just because he really hasn't given any interviews for so many years, and I feel like I've probably thought more about Guns N' Roses than most of America. I could probably do an okay job with that. I always kind of wanted to interview Alan Greenspan. I find him to be a very intriguing
Alan
character.
Greenspan.
Yeah, I always, well, just because I just thought he was, you know, over the last 20 years, who has had a bigger impact on the day-to-day life of Americans? What one person? For every administration, he was the guy, you know? I think it would be interesting to interview Bill Clinton if I really felt that it would be a conversation where there were no limitations and that he wanted to take part of it and he would answer anything. But I think any reporter would say that.
And, you know, I mean, it raises the question. I mean, could you ever get anything original out of Bill Clinton?
Probably not. Probably not. I mean, I thought that he had the most brilliant way to defray any controversy, which was just deny it, deny it, deny it, deny it, deny it, and then say it's old news.
Yeah. Now, you're a rock critic. Have you ever interviewed Bob Dylan?
Now, there's somebody I would also like to interview. Well, yeah, here's why. Because
He's obviously a famously difficult person to interview, especially if you ask him about himself.
Well, and there's a pretty interesting book now. It's like, I think it's just called like Bob Dylan, The Interviews. And it's just a collection of all the interviews he's ever done. And it is amazing how he can sort of turn any interaction into a somewhat sort of like confrontational dialogue. Like there'll be interviews where someone will say like, oh, like, you know, that's a nice shirt, Mr. Dylan. And he'll be like, what? And they'll be like, your garment. That's like a nice garment. And he'll be like, your words, not mine. Like, you know, somehow lies if he's questioning whether or not he's really wearing a shirt.
Bob Dylan, the symbol of the 60s.
To who?
To the youth of the 60s. Wasn't you the symbol?
I didn't ever said that.
Do you think there is any difference between you in the 60s and the Bob Dylan today?
I couldn't tell you. Is there a difference between you in the 60s and you today?
Oh, I think so, yes. Don't you think that your music have developed from the 60s and from...
Possibly.
When you are around and touring as you are now, do you meet, is it in another audience than you met in the 60s?
No, it's usually the same.
Have you failed in reaching the new generation?
I don't know.
But it's... You don't think it's... there is any difference, really, between you and the songs you wrote?
No, I don't personally don't think so.
And as you can see, it's just about impossible to get Dylan to answer a single question.
Well, at this point now, he probably is less difficult. He actually is concerned about his legacy, which for a long time, people were always bringing up to him, and he went out of his way to sort of not consider it. And now he sort of realizes, like, well, you know, I'm going to have this legacy, I'm going to have this imprint, whether I say anything or not, so I might as well... You know, I might as well have some control over, you know, what people are going to say I thought of myself.
Now, I've thought about this because I'm a Dylan fan and, you know, I've heard some bad interviews with him, frankly. And, you know, because he clearly gets uncomfortable if people ask direct questions about his legacy, about, you know, you're the guy who changed rock and roll. He seems to hate that question. And yet, of course, that's the thing that people want to talk. I mean, do you just avoid that question? He clearly likes talking about other rock groups he likes. I mean, that he gets off on talking of being a fan himself.
Yeah. Like Alicia Keys, yeah.
Right. You just go with that? I mean, how would you approach something like that?
Well, you know, like, okay, if somebody doesn't want to talk about something, it doesn't matter how directly you ask it. So if somebody like Dylan, at least, you're not going to bully Bob Dylan into talking about that. If somebody does want to talk about something, a certain subject, but they don't want to deal with it directly, they will bring it up if you sort of talk around it. If Bob Dylan is with a reporter and he wants to mention what he kind of thinks of how people are going to remember, say, the period when he was a Christian or whatever, you know, like, you know, he doesn't talk about that stuff much, but maybe he does. And he decides that this is the reporter that he's going to give this information to. I would guess that if the reporter starts talking about what do you think of Neil Young's legacy, and Bob Dylan starts talking about Neil Young, he will bring the conversation back to himself. I mean, that's always like I usually don't let people ever go off the record. And the reason I don't let them go off the record is because people say they want to have something off the record when they're dying to tell someone, but they don't want to kind of deal with the consequence. So I will just say like, well, you know, they'll go, can I tell you something off the record? And I'll usually go like, well, you've told me all this other great stuff, and I would hate for whatever you tell me now to sort of contradict that. So it's like, you know, I don't want to know anything you don't want to tell me, so let's just kind of, you know. And then they'll tell you anyway. You know, they'll always say it, you know. I don't know. It's like it would be all these kind of theories about interviewing I've just put out, like, would they work if I actually was with Dylan? I don't know. It would be an interesting experience, mm-hmm. you know?
Chuck Klosterman is critic and cultural commentator. His latest book is called Chuck Klosterman 4. Steve Paulson spoke with him. Coming up, The Onion looks back at Election 08.
Responding to criticisms that he lacks the experience to lead the nation, Barack Obama announced today that he has begun participating in a presidential internship program.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Joe Garden is features editor at the satirical paper The Onion. The Onion's been covering the election along with the rest of the country's comedy writers and found it to be a fruitful season.
A slight mishap on the campaign trail for John McCain. Staffers confirmed this morning that the 72-year-old senator was accidentally left on his campaign bus overnight after a speech in Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania. Joining us now from the War for the White House election analysis bunker with details is Jane Carmichael. Good to see you, Jane.
Hi, Andrea.
Now, how did campaign officials discover they had left Senator McCain all by himself?
Well, Andrea, according to a campaign spokesman, at just after 7 a.m., two local Stroudsburg residents were taking a morning walk when they noticed a forlorn looking McCain staring out a window on the bus.
Uh-huh.
When they asked him if he wanted to be let out, the senator nodded yes, and the women opened the door. We spoke with the women earlier via phone.
Comedy produced by The Onion. According to Joe Garden, it was a great election season that lasted way too long.
We had far too long. I'm going to make it my personal goal to try to get the election cycle down to 5 months so we can stop writing jokes for such a long time on such a dull subject. But we had first, you had the Democratic campaign where everybody was thinking it was going to be Hillary Clinton.
Making fun of Hillary Clinton first and then?
Pretty much. And then John Edwards, who vowed – we had a headline, John Edwards vows to eliminate bad things by 2012. So it was so we thought he was going to be in for a little while longer. And then,
I really liked that one, by the way. Is that – because I think toward the end of it, Rudy Giuliani says, hey, there's nothing wrong with bad things.
Well, that's the thing. The other thing about that, it's funny you should mention him because I remember one of the other headlines we wrote around that time was when I was thinking that Giuliani was going to be the front runner in the Republican side, and I wrote a story about John McCain, and it was McCain late to debate due to Greyhound delays because at that time his campaign was
he was running out of money, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was out of money. He was broke, and he sort of like runs on stage after they started. He's like, "Sorry, I'm late." Sort of putting on his microphone, and then he sort of at the end he sort of runs backstage to fill his pockets with sandwich meat and bottled water.
Yeah, there's so a whole thing in there too about how he couldn't call ahead because he ran out of minutes on his
his prepaid cell phone.
Right.
I mean, it really was like, it really felt like at the time it kind of felt like a really mean story. But, I mean, he probably had the last laugh because here it was. He was able to get past that.
Well, we ought to talk about that a little bit because you say it sounded like a really mean story. Don't you ever worry that sometimes you're being just a little too nasty?
I don't really. I think if our target is right or if we are making a comment about the right thing, I don't really think that we're being nasty, at least politically or celebrity-wise. There are stories that we've done outside of that I think are a little bit, perhaps a little bit off color, but usually I don't really think I don't think we should be limited by what's nasty and what isn't nasty.
Right.
So in short, my personal aesthetic should never really enter into it. Because
of course,
to
some extent it must be up to the hearer, the reader, the listener, whether you think it's nasty or not. I mean, if you're John McCain, some of the stuff that has come out from the entertainment media hasn't been very good. A lot of the jokes seem to have been at his expense during this election cycle.
It's true. But a lot of the events, a lot of the jokes that came out were sort of based in the same John McCain is old saw. And that was, you know, that's not really challenging. So it was up to us. We were trying to figure out ways to say something new about him.
You did a variation on that with one an audio clip, I think, in which you did a whole piece about him being left on a bus.
We did do that, yes. Oh, I shouldn't make sweeping generalizations only to be caught by the ambush media. What was the phrase, actually? It wasn't ambush media. It was the gotcha media, excuse me. Which is another great, hilarious thing about this past campaign.
The accusation was made that Obama was getting more press coverage, and I don't know whether that's true or not. But
I know it was probably true for The Onion. We ran more Obama stories just because we thought there were different ways. You know, we found different ways to actually go at Obama, where it wasn't like we were making fun of Obama, but it didn't seem like it was. It also seemed like we were making a salient point. Whereas with McCain, we just didn't want to attack without having, you know, make an attacky, too many attacky jokes, I guess.
Okay, so tell me the salient point about creating Obama's brother, Cooter.
The hillbilly half brother, Cooter Obama? It was Obama campaign nearly derailed by appearance of hillbilly half brother. I wrote that story, and I'm actually very proud of that story because it. Well, I was happy to do it, too, because it enabled me to look up details of the brief Billy Carter saga our country endured. And I had completely forgotten, or I don't even think I knew, that at some point in full view of visiting dignitaries, Billy Carter stopped and urinated on a runway. And it's just like, and so there's the thing.
It's hard to be funny when things really happened, isn't it?
But the great thing was, you know, you had that with Carter. With Clinton, you had Roger Clinton. With Bush, well, the hillbilly half brother got into office that time. But there's, but with Obama, you just didn't. There was like Obama was so, you know, so erudite and so together, and his campaign was going so solidly. Like, what could possibly stop this campaign right now? Oh, if sort of a Roger Clinton character shows up, and so we just made him Cooter Obama, who showed up with a jug of moonshine and a truck full of pigs.
He lost, and I think if I remember that story correctly, he got dumped from chicken killing school.
he was kicked out after he inadvertently dropped an air conditioner on the dean's head. But I will say this, just a little side note about that story. It makes me very, very happy to have my job when I can be sitting in a graphics office discussing the picture of a, you know, Cooter Obama on the White House lawn with a beaten up truck full of pigs and having a discussion with my editor about whether it's too many pigs or not enough pigs. That was settled by somebody who just happened to be walking by at that time, and he just sort of said, "Too many pigs, not enough pigs. Put more pigs in that picture." And so that was it. There were then more pigs in the picture.
Must be fun to work at The Onion because you guys have a little longer leash than the rest of the press. You can say not everything you want, I suppose, but you can get away with a lot.
We can say whatever we want so long as we do it in the right vein, I think. We're certainly not going to feel constrained by, you know, whether we're on message politically or whether we are, we can also, because we're not constrained by the actual facts, we can actually strike at a greater truth, which is merciful. Mm-hmm. It enables us to say things that may seem, you know, on the surface stupid, but deep down actually have substance to them.
There was an article just recently, I thought actually it was quite a good article, and I can't quote the title, but I can say that the title begins, "Nation finally," and there's a word I can't say, "enough to make social progress."
Well, this is paraphrased, "Nation finally bad enough to make social progress." Yeah, I mean, that was actually, you know, that was actually really, and there again, it's like you can say something just as bluntly as possible, and you can talk about how, you know, and that was, you know, for us, that was a really fun story to write because we were trying to point out that, you know, we're still at war in two countries, you know, the unemployment is rising, people's retirements are evaporating. And so this is what it's come to. The things have to get this bad in order to finally put an African-American in the White House.
You quote Obama on the front page of it as saying, "Today the American people have made their voices heard and they've said things are finally as terrible as we're willing to tolerate. To elect a black man in this country at this time, these last 8 years must have really broken you. A great day for our nation." It's funny. But it's also, it's one of those funny things that you kind of sigh as you laugh about.
There's a lot of that in The Onion. I mean, we try to, you know, we do, our main goal is to be funny. But if we can actually – but our best – I mean our main goal is to be funny, but our best articles are the ones that sort of – that actually have a point of view to them and actually make you think about what you're – about it and contextualize things. I think that that's probably one of the gifts The Onion actually may offer to people, is it gives them a different medium or different means with which to process something. You know, processing things through humor allows you to analyze something in a different way, and I think that's very important.
Is that what's...
I hope it's very important. I don't think I'm personally very important, but I think it's good for people to have that that option.
You know, it's almost a shame, isn't it? This long period is over. You went through the primaries. You finally got two candidates. They ran for what seemed like years. One of them finally got elected. How do you feel at The Onion about having Barack Obama in the White House? Is there room for comedy after this?
How can I explain this? I do very bad with pet metaphors, but I'm going to try anyway. Let's say you have a crazy cat lady, and she throws a bunch of food on the floor, and everybody's wrestling for the same scraps of food. There's only so much out there, and we would have to be scrambling against so many people to make the same Sarah Palin jokes. With Obama, however, it's going to be a little bit harder. It's going to winnow out the lazy commentator and the lazy comedian. And I think that the strong will survive. I hope we're one of those strong.
So an Obama presidency is a greater challenge for the comic, and that's something to look forward to.
An Obama presidency is basically the social Darwinism, comedic social Darwinism in action.
Joe Garden is featured at The Onion, a satirical newspaper. Just about everybody's killed time in line at the grocery store reading the tabloid headlines. And the pervasiveness of tabloid culture is something we take for granted today. But the tabloids in America were painstakingly built on an idea by a second-generation Italian immigrant called Generoso Pope. Jack Vitek tells Pope's story in his book The Godfather of Tabloid, Generoso Pope and the National Enquirer. He told Anne Strainchamps how Pope got the idea for the Enquirer's style of coverage.
One day he was passing an accident, and he saw everybody looking at the gore, and they were so excited and fascinated. He himself didn't like gore, he said. He got sick at his stomach, but he said, well, if that's what they want, that's what I'll give them. And one of his best-selling papers after that was he bought or acquired the pictures of Oswald's autopsy and published them. One of the more famous pictures he published was of a New York City policeman wearing a rubber glove, carrying by the hair a severed head from a subway accident. He got into that kind of fascination with violence and gore.
And the
freaks,
papers sold
freaks.
Like hotcakes, right?
It did. But he couldn't get his circulation over a million. He was out of the red ink. He was making good money. And he got the idea, not his own original idea, but he got it from somebody. Really, the way the Enquirer evolved was from a rather intense discourse between Pope and his reporters and his readers and the courts, actually. But it was decided to put this paper in the supermarkets, and he did it. And I think you have to imagine what a monumental project that would be, you know, to do that.
So one of the huge sort of remarkable achievements is that he turned the Enquirer from this little tiny newspaper struggling into this, you know, this enormous operation with, it must have been in its heyday, hundreds of stringers and as well as full-time reporters. What was it like to work there?
Well, I have a lot of accounts. He was a very tyrannical man, very controlling. He fired people quickly and impulsively and in large groups. He fired, famously, one Friday afternoon, 13 reporters at once.
In fact, wasn't he notorious for firing people on Fridays? Did some remark, somebody said, you learned never to pick up the intercom at 3 on Friday afternoon.
That's right. That was Phil Brennan I interviewed. And Phil was fired on his birthday, at his birthday party. The intercom rang and they were just bringing in his cake and the candles were burning. And he was called in and fired, you know. Actually, what happened is they would meet afterwards in the bars of Lantana and tell the tale. He fired, basically fired a woman for having cosmetic surgery.
Oh, that was when he said she worked better with her old nose.
Yes, yes, yes. And he was able to say things like that and get away with it. Of course, he never put it on paper or anything. And fired a, this was way back, but in the Enquirer offices, it was a sprawling, low-key, kind of hidden place in a small town in Florida. But when you got your coffee from the coffee station, you had to put a lid on your coffee when you walked back to your desk, no matter how close your desk was. And that was because a reporter had once spilled coffee on the rug and got himself fired for doing it. So that was a trace of his impulsiveness. And there's a story that he, early on, when he was still back in New York, he fired a man for stepping in front of him in the elevator. And the man turned to him and said, I don't work for you. I'm just here making a delivery. So he could fire people who didn't even work for him.
So did all this create a climate of fear? Or because I also have the impression from all the interviews you did and the stories people told that the place was also kind of like a circus and there was a strange kind of pride a lot of reporters had.
Indeed, indeed. I think that compared to mainstream journalism, working on the Enquirer was like being on a pirate ship. You had a kind of piratical temperament, and they were a very wild crew. Well, they did a lot of stunt journalism. They were very tricky. In the period of time when a lot of celebrities were going to the Betty Ford Clinic for rehab, it was very likely they would run into an Enquirer reporter who was also in rehab. Things like that. There was stunt journalism, which was pretty wild. It was almost an initiation when a reporter came down for a tryout. He would have to engage in some kind of stunt journalism.
What's stunt journalism?
Well, it basically comes from Hearst, but he had a reporter live in a box on the street to tell what it was like to be homeless. He was a specialist. He boxed a kangaroo and lost. A lot of it involved costumes. Oh, and they, I think this was one of the, he was an Australian, he had a very pronounced Australian accent, which he could make even more pronounced. And they dressed him up as a downed space alien and sent him into a small town.
Some of their tricks wound up making the mainstream news as well. There was a famous, wasn't it an Enquirer reporter who tried to get hold of or did get hold of Henry Kissinger's trash?
Indeed. That was Jay Gorley, who wrote up this for Washington Monthly. I think it's a really significant story in understanding how the mainstream and the tabloids interact. I made the point that the tabloids deal in the abject, in what's rejected, things that we don't want to admit that's in us. Our meanness, our fascination with violence and blood and so on. And what could possibly be more abject than garbage? So he went to the Georgetown residence of Kissinger and grabbed his trash bags and started making a getaway. And the Secret Service was nonplussed, but they stopped him and they said, you can't do this. They said, you either give up the trash or you go to jail. So he said, jail, jail, that'll be fine, you know, because it would probably have been an even better story to be jailed. But then they realized, oh, and he also had a White House press pass on him. So they were completely stymied. And finally, they had to give up the garbage. And he took it home and made an inventory of it and wrote it up. And there was some interesting and significant things in there. It was a very good story idea. And the mainstream press was outraged that the Enquirer did this. Nevertheless, they put the story on their front pages, telling about how dull this story was and that it really wasn't the story at all. And the Washington Post, I think in an editorial, called it the equivalent of child molesting. That's how strongly they reacted. I think that the serious things that the reporter found in the garbage was an itinerary of where Kissinger had been, and it didn't match with what the reporters were being told.
Oh, so, the official itinerary.
That's right. So he was talking to bankers that weren't on the itinerary, and so the reporter said, well, who's publishing trash here, the Inquirer or the National Press?
That is a really fascinating story, and for the larger questions it raises, because I always thought the Inquirer published lies, that it was just a pack of made-up stuff, grandma sees space alien and, woman has 48 babies.
Yep.
But maybe there's more to it.
There is more to it. And I always thought it would be interesting if they published how many lies were in there, like the proof of a liquor, this is 100 proof liquor, or this is 80 proof liquor. This is an 80 proof truth story, because the tactic was to blur the line between fiction and reality. And if people thought it was totally fiction, it wouldn't work. And if it was totally real, it would be dull. So there was an awful lot of hype in it, to the point that it amounted to lying.
They were willing to spend an enormous amount of money for certain big things that they really wanted. Pope, for instance, let it be known at Elvis's funeral, Presley's funeral, that he wanted a photo of Presley in the coffin.
Right.
This was practically ungettable, and yet they got it.
Yes. It was a real picture, too.
What did they do?
One of the interesting things about Pope spending money is that he would spend money incredibly recklessly. When the Inquirer went to the Elvis funeral, it was 40 reporters. They wrote contracts. They carried cash for bribes or contracts. They traveled in Learjets and helicopters. And I think they entered the national scene in a stunning way. And he was using his enterprising, buccaneering British reporters. So the idea of these guys running around Graceland with pockets full of cash and these twisted London accents and riding around in helicopters must have been pretty astounding. And he wrote a contract with Elvis's girlfriend for $100,000 to tell her story, things like that. I talked to Tom Kunsel, who was the executive editor who directed the coverage. He said he bought every Minox camera within a 3-state radius to pass out to people who had the privilege of going through the viewing line of the coffin, and they were to snap a picture. He said it was a fairly comical enterprise because they dressed up people as nuns and priests and so on. The thing was so well guarded, and there were 2 karate experts there, and by the time they got up to the coffin, they just wouldn't pull the camera out because they were under pretty close scrutiny. But finally, a distant cousin got that picture with one of Kunsel's Minox cameras, and they ran it to the Learjet waiting on the runway and sent it back to the Inquirer. And the picture that ran on the front page of the Inquirer and took up, it was the only picture on the front page, was of Elvis lying in his coffin, and all you can see is his face. And that's it. Of course, that was the high water mark of tabloid publishing, I think of newspaper publishing. He sold 6.7 million copies. Kunsel said that he thought the printer ran out of paper. He was telling them to go to 8, and he doesn't think they had enough paper to complete the run. I think that started the whole iconization of Elvis, all this stuff that goes on about him. He looked like a failure. He looked like a flop. They tried to, Kunsel said that the stories they ran in the previous year hadn't sold very well, but that Pope just had an intuition about this and it was right.
So the Inquirer, in some ways, was such a success that it kind of sank beneath this burgeoning wave. I mean, tabloid journalism kind of took off, and then with the birth of the Internet, spread all over the Internet also.
Yes, and TV.
Yeah.
Pope he missed the opportunity to do tabloid TV, but there was a period there, and basically Rupert Murdoch took that on and carried on the tabloid torch, and founded Fox News, which was, I'm arguing, a tabloid station. So I would say that he defended this area. Other people have taken it on. He didn't want to go into tabloid TV, I think, because he enjoyed this controlling this small pond, which really it was in a small town in Florida. And that's another way of answering the question is, why don't we know him better? He just liked to stay there. He wouldn't behave like a mogul. He wouldn't do bold things that Murdoch later did. And he was once asked, I thought this was a very nice interview, he was once asked by a reporter why he didn't go into tabloid TV. And he interpreted that to mean, well, why don't you want to make more money? And he said, well, how many cheeseburgers can I eat?
Jack Vitek teaches journalism at Edgewood College in Madison, Wisconsin. He's the author of The Godfather of Tabloid. What do you make of tabloid culture in America? You can let us know and get more information on the books and music you hear on To the Best of Our Knowledge by stopping by our website. It's ttbook.org. We always love to hear from you. Coming up, a conversation with groundbreaking journalist Gay Talese. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. In today's media world of quick and easy stories, Gay Talese is an exception, an influential member of the literary journalism movement since the 60s. Talese is a master of in-depth profiles, telling his stories through detailed scenes. Talese built a name for himself by making stars like Joe DiMaggio and Frank Sinatra seem human, and writes about his career in the memoir A Writer's Life. He told Steve Paulson why he loves The Loser.
Yes, I am among those who do love sports. I'll tell you why. The reason I like being around sports is that you're there. You see the performer. You may be on the sidelines. You might be in the press box. So much of what we write these days, if we're, let's say, a political writer, a foreign correspondent in Iraq or in Afghanistan or somewhere, you write about what people tell you, not what you saw.
Well, it strikes me that you also have tended to do something in particular with your writing about various sports figures. You seem to be more drawn to the losers than the winners.
Well, I think that I've written about some winners, like Muhammad Ali was certainly a winner, but he's a loser too. So many of your great winners are great losers, meaning that they have experienced the depth of falling from the very pinnacle since they're at the top. And like Ali had to fall back not only on his back when he was knocked out by people far inferior in their prime than he and his, but he also lost his voice. He's a victim of Parkinson's, and I tried to communicate with him, and I couldn't do much because I couldn't hear him.
Let me ask you about one of the people you wrote about back in the 60s, Floyd Patterson, who once had been the heavyweight champion, but then you wrote about him after Sonny Liston had knocked him out for the second time. In fact, your story was called The Loser, and I have to say—
That was chosen by an editor, but I did write about Patterson. You know what's good about him? Because he was articulate. He was able to tell you what it was like to be knocked out. And one time I spent days going over the notes and with him of what it was like to be knocked out. What do you think? Do you see stars? You know, all this cliche, you see some guy in the ring and he's on the floor and the cartoonist puts stars up there in the ceiling as if that's what fighters see. So the fighter becomes the chronicler of himself. He becomes the spokesperson for himself. He becomes the reminiscer of this awful experience in public, going down, losing your, falling on your back and knowing you're an embarrassment for the moment to yourself and to those who supported you, your ring supporters and the people who bet on you to win. And then you have to walk past those people up the aisle. They carry you or help you go to your dressing room. And then the sports writers come storming in there. And what happened? What happened? Why'd you do? How come you got hit? I mean, you know, all that constant harping upon. humiliation. I think it's really not a very desirable situation to be in, but he was a champion and he could talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Now, is it true that you interviewed Floyd Patterson 37 times for that story?
Yes. It was for Esquire magazine in the old days, that when you had a lot of room and a lot of time to write. It's not true now. But in the old days, I wrote for Esquire about this, and they put the title "The Loser." I thought, that's not fair, really. That title, I have nothing to do, as you know, writers don't write the titles. But I thought, this guy's a winner, really. You know why? Because he gets knocked down more than any other. He lost more fights, and he got knocked down more than any fighter that I knew about. But he got up off the floor more. I mean, that's not a record you can prove, but it is a record, I think, that is relevant. People who get off the floor, who rise from their declining and diminished state, as a losing fighter is personifies a diminished state, lying on your back in a reclining position.
Mm-hmm.
But he climbs up, and he climbs up and tries to keep going. That thing's great.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I want to ask you a little bit about how you wrote that story, because, I mean, one of your trademarks is you spend an awful lot of time with the subjects you write about, and you must have spent days or weeks with Floyd Patterson and, you know, interviewed him multiple times. Doesn't he get sick of you?
Well, it isn't that he gets sick of me or I get sick of him. What you have to do what I want to do is patience, and you have to have an eye and an ear for more than just the person you're talking about. I'm more an atmospheric writer. I'm interested in writing about situations and scenes, rather like maybe a filmmaker or a cameraman or a person who is a painter or a novelist. You know, it isn't that the writing of you're describing. You know, when Capote wrote the great nonfiction book that was called In Cold Blood, it doesn't start with a murder. It starts with a description of the Kansas farmland in which the Cutter family, the family that was murdered. But the opening of that is atmospheric, as my books are all very atmospheric, and the articles as well.
Well, it strikes me that you also did that. I mean, that whole business of telling a story through scenes with your famous magazine story about Frank Sinatra. Frank Sinatra has a cold. I mean, it's one
same
scene
thing
after another, almost like one set piece after another.
You're absolutely right. And like, Sinatra's famous. I didn't write about Sinatra as a famous person. I wrote about him as a person who meant a lot to those who depended on him for their own sense of well-being and welfare. And I wrote about stardom, not Sinatra's only, but the idea of being celebrated and a star figure in that time in the United States. And now we're even more of a celebrity culture.
Mm-hmm.
But I was really writing almost the anti-celebrity piece then. And I'm now writing like the anti-memoir. I don't like the memoir necessarily because it's very linear and it's very me, me, me. It's almost narcissistic, and I don't really share that interest in being that way.
Let me ask you about another magazine piece you wrote back in the 60s, getting at this whole issue of puncturing celebrity, your story about Joe DiMaggio after he retired. It was the mid-60s. He was still one of the most famous athletes alive, and that story you did was famous for the way it cut through his celebrity in a way that really had never been done before, it seems to me, with a star of that magnitude.
Well, it's really about mythology. The DiMaggio story was connected to Marilyn Monroe. That marriage really did capture the imagination of the American people. And of course, you know, after she married DiMaggio, she married Arthur Miller, and that affected his life. He wrote plays about her. He didn't necessarily call her Marilyn Monroe, but everyone knew. But my story about DiMaggio was not when he was at the top of his game. I often write about people like this who years and years and years later are living in the past but still have to deal with the present. This is true of DiMaggio. It's true of Sinatra in a way. And it's true of all the stories I write. So it isn't – I wouldn't – if I was 25 years old now and I was working for, let's say, Vanity Fair, just as an example – I wouldn't want to do the stories you'd have to do to get into Vanity Fair, because the stories you have to do to get a cover story or a lead story in Vanity Fair is about some celebrity. And I mean the here and now celebrity.
Mm-hmm.
You would have to do, I don't know who the biggest movie star is. I can't really tell you. But whoever has got the latest, you know, Baskin-Robbins flavor of the month 4-star label on their nose would be what would appeal to a celebrity magazine like Vanity Fair. And the whole idea of just temporary interest, topicality, I back away from what is topical, what is of the moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of history, in every history of the new journalism, your name is mentioned very prominently. Tom Wolfe has said you were the person who really started the new journalism. Well, do you see it that way?
Oh, no. I mean, Tom is a friend of mine, and he was flattering, and he was giving me attention back in the 60s when I didn't have much attention at all, but he did, because he's famous himself, open up my work to many of the people who are academicians and, you know, professors of writing, and they started reading me. And I owe Tom Wolfe thanks for that, but also I don't owe him thanks for this. He created this term called new journalism. I wasn't necessarily doing anything journalistic or anything new. There were people writing back in the 30s. I mean, John Steinbeck, Ernest Hemingway were doing journalism. There were many people who are more close to my age, but before my time, who were doing good journalism. John Hersey in his story of the Hiroshima, that's very good. But the problem with the term that Tom Wolfe coined, in a way, there are a lot of so-called, later on, new journalists who faked it. They were like James Fry. And I didn't want to be linked with people who were all filled with opinion. They were very impressionistic. They didn't do the footwork, the legwork. You know what I mean by that.
Mm-hmm. The reporting.
Were out there, the reporting, the serious reporting. There are people that half report. You know, they just get one fact right and they don't take the time to get it all right. And they would then be called new journalists because they had a flashy way of writing. It was very attention-getting and very unlike me. They would use first person, me, all the way through. And I'm not going to belabor the point, but even Hunter Thompson, I don't want to be mixed up with. Hunter Thompson was a flashy writer. He was very entertaining. I mean, but it was exaggerated. And I have mixed emotions. I don't want to be a new journalist. I don't think that I am anything new. I think that what I was doing was storytelling. And storytelling is as old as – it's centuries and centuries old. And I associate myself with being a storyteller. That's all.
Gay Talese is a celebrated writer and journalist. His memoir is called A Writer's Life. Steve Paulson spoke with him. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Meet the Press, number 1116A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Veronica Rickert, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, and Doug Gordon, and Madeline Mahon. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.